Are you on? Okay. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming to our talk today. We're going to be talking about pies today, how to bake them, how to make them, how to throw them, how to avoid having them thrown at you. Actually, we're talking about a different kind of pie, but how they're split up and whether they should be split up in a different way. We've got a great panel here. Next to me is Steve Greenberg, who formerly president of Columbia Records, and with his own label S-Curve, Andy Grammer, very well-known artist, Fountains of Wayne, Duran Duran, Tom Jones he has worked with, AJR, and a new artist, Netta, who won the Euro Song Contest, has billions of streams, and so he's well positioned to talk about all of that. And also Baja Men, you may have heard of Who Let the Dogs Out. And, you know, it was very, went viral. It went through the woof, as they said. It was actually a surprise hit at South by Southwest in 2019 before the pandemic. That movie was shown here. You know, no one knows better than Steve the importance of a song and the relationship between the song and who's singing the song. By the way, were you, who did the bark on that?
That was me.
Went through the woof.
There you go. My dirty secret revealed.
Okay. And then we have next to him Agnes Kosicki, who is a director at RBC.
That's not me.
I'm sorry, I'm going blind here.
Confusion.
So Olivier Chastain, founder and CEO of Iconoclast, a brand and rights management company that has acquired music rights recently of Robbie Robertson and the band, with all that great music. It was called the second greatest album of all time by... And what was next to Sergeant Pepper's? I think it was Roger Waters who said that.
Yes.
And, you know, love him or hate him, he's got great taste. So you have to say that about him. And that's amazing. And he has worked on acquisition deals for involving the Beach Boys, David Crosby, Linda Ronstadt, many others. And not only publishing rights, but master rights, and also name and likeness rights, looking toward the future. And he's got some great things to say about that and branding of the artist and the songs as well. And then next to him is Agnes Kosicki. And she's director at RBC Capital Markets, focused on entertainment investment banking. She specializes in advisory and capital raising activities for content, IP services, and music clients. And she handles debt and equity financing, buy-side and sell-side mandates, and initial public offerings as well. Agnes joined RBC in 2010, spending 6 years as part of the Toronto office before moving to LA, where I'm located. And she also has significantly advised Hypnosis and other high-profile companies in this space. I'm a music and media attorney based in Los Angeles. And so I'm going to start off, you know, with the amazing fact that you may know of, that the three major music groups, Universal, Sony, Warner, together on the record side and the publishing side, reportedly make $2 million per hour in streaming income. That's over $17.5 billion a year. And the question is, how is it being split up? It's being split up about 4 or 5 to 1 in favor of the labels. And so my first question to my esteemed panelists is, and I will start with you, Agnes, is, you know, is as Is it fair? What do you think, as an investment executive and advisor, how do you feel about the labels taking 4 to 5 times of that pie versus the publisher?
Yeah, no, Bill, that's a great question. Can everybody hear me? Great. I think the gap is so big. I think we can start with the basics. There's 2 copyrights to every song, right? You have the vocals, you have the melody and the lyrics. You need both components. I don't know why one would be worth so much more than the other. I think it's an industry flaw. The record labels are negotiating streaming rates in a free market while the publishers have their rates dictated to them by the CRB. So, you know, when you look at other royalty splits, like Sync, right, that's a 50-50 split. So I don't think, and why would the streaming be split differently than that? I think the recorded labels, and Olivia and Steve can probably speak better to this, but there's been so much technological advancements. I think the studios are run in more efficient ways, so I don't think the argument can be used with the costs that they had back in the day manufacturing CDs, and it was just a very different business model.
Yeah, thank you. And Olivier, what do you think? Does it make sense for labels or master owners to take so much of the pie?
Yeah, I mean, I invest in both. So I own sound recordings and publishing, so I'm sort of right.
Is your mic on?
I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. I think you got to get up closer to it.
Yeah, so as I was saying, yes, I'm investing in both. So for me, it's not that it makes me neutral, but I see both sides. I think the key thing is to look back historically why that's happening. For many years, if you go back to really, let's say, up to the mid-2000s, the burden of the risk was really on the labels. They were really the ones who were spending the money on the new artist, spending the money on marketing, promotion, etc., very much like a venture capital fund, while the publishers were a bit more dusty and their roles were much more about collection, sometimes about sync, but 90% of the time was ensuring collection, which used to be much more complicated if you go back, whether it was collecting mechanicals from labels, which you had to do directly, dealing with PROs around the world, etc. With the rationalization of digital, there's an argument to be made that maybe the publisher should get more. Should it be equal? It depends on how you estimate the role of the labels. If your view is that the labels are still the driver of new talent, yes. But when you're in a market where 60-70% of the income from streaming goes to back catalog, it's sort of questioning whether the it should be adjusted. I don't think, and I hate to say this because I'm primarily a publisher, I think it'd be hard to justify an exact 50-50 on every income type. Ideally, what it should be is new talent that require incredible amount of investments. Maybe you should be getting the equivalent of what used to be the control composition clause, let's say on mechanicals, which was one of the way to favor the labels on minimizing their cost. I think it's difficult to make the case that it should be an exact split due to the original investment of the labels. At the same time, 5 years later, 10 years later, my view it should be an equal, but it's too complicated to manage it that way.
So now, and this is Steve for you, I mean, should labels be partying like it's 1999? I mean, they are not manufacturing companies anymore. They are marketing companies now. And so to your point, both of you, that it's not the same kind of investment, and the development of artists is not what it used to be back when you were the president of Columbia Records. So what is your feeling, and you're coming at it more from the label side?
Well, I have a label, but I also have a publishing company and have historically published a lot of the artists on the label. I'm also a manager of a successful band called AJR, and they make money both on the recorded music side and the publishing side. So I also, like Olivia, I think see it from both sides. I don't need to be convinced that the split is unfair between the record side and the publishing side. The publishing side is worth a lot more than what it's getting in the streaming world right now. I think as Olivier said, there's a lot of historic baggage with all this stuff, because I think what happens is we always kind of inherit the business models of the old era when we enter a new era, and that's kind of where we are now. You know, in the olden days, right, the record company made a lot of money selling the records, but of course had a lot of costs. There was a fixed mechanical royalty that the songwriters and publishers got for every song that was sold, but there was also like a little extra revenue stream that was, for many acts, certainly for hit acts, the dominant revenue stream, which was public performance, radio airplay. Like in the United States of America, still to this day, publishers and songwriters get paid when their songs are on the radio, but singers and labels don't get paid when their songs are on the radio. So that was a very big chunk of the pie, but obviously the pie is changing very rapidly, and with so much consumer listening switching to streaming over the years, and we can sort of see, we don't know how soon it'll be, but we can certainly see the demise of terrestrial radio and the public performance income that comes from that at some point in the future. We know that a new model needs to be created, and it's and I do think that the songwriters and publishers need to keep exerting pressure to have a bigger piece of that pie. The problem is that the pie kind of can't get any bigger. The DSPs, as big and as much money as they generate, do have a kind of very thin profit margin, with most of the money going to the rights holders, and it's really a question of how the pie will be split up, as opposed to the DSPs making a bigger pie. The only way to make a bigger pie, really, is to have more consumption.
Can I add something?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I think part of the way we should think about it, which is really difficult to implement, is to look per income type. So if you think about it, on the publishing side, you have mechanical, which is the income paid by the labels and streaming services to the publishers and the writers. Then performance, which is really for broadcast, SiriusXM, whatever you think of it as, more, you know, not based on a single unit being consumed. And then the sync, and I'll leave the other, which is black box and print business. It's irrelevant in this conversation. And so for sync, where you're rewarding the creation of a song and a sound recording, and it's a free market negotiation. If somebody is from Coca-Cola, I'll tell and name a price, they can counter. I mean, we negotiate it totally like you would negotiate something without government intervention. So that the 50-50 has been established for a long, long time. I mean, it's historically always been the case, where you split this equally between publisher and the label. On the mechanical, I think that's a cost used to be borne by the record labels, now borne by the DSPs. And the other side, which is the other 50%, gets paid to the PROs. So if you're Spotify today, you're going to be paying a rate, so it's roughly 12.5% of the earnings, just to simplify, and that gets split half to mechanicals, so paid to the publishers, who are going to then account to the writers, and half gets paid to the PROs. And so the best way for me to rectify the pie is to really look as to where the effort is being spent in there. And so I think you could make a case that for mechanicals, maybe that should be reduced, meaning not reduced, but kept at, you know, the same level or lower level. But for the rest, I agree with Steve, whether it's on all the performance income should definitely be raised.
So to the point about effort, you know, I represent, for example, the estate of Curtis Mayfield, and it's becoming very popular for syncs. And we're always getting approached by the publisher, you know, much more than by the labels. In that case, with the impressions, it would be Universal, mm-hmm. and with his solo career, Warner. But it seems the publishers are really driving the sync more than the labels. But that may not be the case. That may just be what I'm seeing in that case.
Yeah, I think also a lot of the publishers, if you're talking especially the indie market, the Reservoir, the Hypnosis, myself, etc., you know, there's some pressure to have a return on investment. If you're a major, you know, you've had this catalog for 50, 60 years, you don't have the same pressure. So I right. think a lot of the role, and that's another part of the pie, is that the balance between the labels and publishers is changing because the role of the publisher has changed. Publishers are way more active than they used to be.
You know, so I just want to turn a little philosophical here about this whole thing, and or look sort of make an analogy, if you will, between a songwriter. Let's just look at the songwriter versus the singer, and compare it to the architect versus the skyscraper builder. And in that case, there's no question that it's the builder of the skyscraper, the investors, that make a lot more of the pie than the architect. Or you could analogize it to the film business, where you have a screenwriter who might be similar to a songwriter, versus the star, the director, the producers and investors. I mean, it just seems to me the common thread there is that we as a society tend to value more the end product, if you will, whether it's physical, tangible thing like a building or a digital thing as well, than the blueprint, if you will. And the song is sort of a blueprint, isn't it? But so that I guess I'm sort of arguing for the label side, right? So I'm kind of saying that if I'm a label, I'm gonna look at both sides. I'm gonna say that's why the song doesn't get as much of the pie as the machine behind the ones singing the song, so to speak. What do you guys? Anyone have a thought on that? Is that would there be pushback on the publisher side and say, well, we can, you know, that's not right. It shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, I think historically it just never was the case. I think that this we are living in a period that's an anomaly where the pie has where the income has shifted so dramatically to the labels and the artists as opposed to the writers and the publishers. It just never was like that. If you took a hit single. In the era of sales, where the songwriter might have gotten, say, an 8-cent mechanical royalty on the sale of the single, I'm not sure that after reducing for all the costs, all the recoupable costs and the marketing costs and everything, I'm not sure that the artist actually was making much more than that, even if he was making that. And I think there was much more parity in the fruits of a hit single than there is now. This is really like a new thing, I think, that we've entered into. And I do think it needs to be corrected. I don't think anybody ever used to think that recordings were more valuable than songs. In fact, a lot of people would tell you historically in the music business that the place to be if you want to really make money was in publishing, not in the record business. And I think again, if you threw in the public performance money from a hit song, probably the songwriter made more money off the hit song than the singer. So it really has flipped pretty dramatically in the last few years.
Anyone else want to hit that one? No. Yeah. No. Well, yes. Let me then ask the audience: how many songwriters are there? Any songwriters out here? Okay. And what about artists? We have any artists? And what about artists who are not songwriters? No? Okay, so you're all writing your own music. That has changed too, hasn't it? We have, with especially pop and hip-hop and stuff, is you have so many outside writers involved. So yeah. Do you want to talk to that?
Yeah, I think that's a change from, let's say, roughly the 90s. Where the songwriting camps started happening, and you see that mirrored as well in the publishers, the role of the publishers, where more and more the development that the especially the majors used to do has been outsourced to producers, partially managers, And a lot of the producers tend to be songwriting camps. So if you look at Dr. Luke, Max Martin, I looked after the Brunetta brothers, you know, for when I was at Big Deal Music, saying, you know, did, you know, all the, you know, One Direction and all the songs, and it's very much where it starts. So, you know, the expression was always that songs are the blood of our business. They are. I mean, that's, to your point, Bill, they're sort of the foundation. But it's more today. I mean, if you look at Max Martin, he's effectively taking most of the functions in development and A&R of a label, and then pretty much passing this back to the label to just become the accelerator that's going to hopefully blow this up around the world. Yeah. And so, again, going back to the pie, you know, that A&R investment that used to be a multi-year investment. If you go back to, I'm old enough where, you know, I got to work with, you know, the Ahmet Ertegun of the world, and these people used to be, yeah, you were in for three albums. Not the case today. That risk is being borne usually by someone else, and that someone else is usually a producer, a manager, a production company. And if you think of all these groups of songwriters that work under Max Martin and Dr. Luke, where they're the 15% of your pie, and yet they are effectively starting those records. So again, it's so granular that it's so difficult to say that should be the rules. It's, I don't want to say it's a case-per-case basis, but, you know, depending on the maturity of the song, depending on the genre, depending on the function of the publisher, you can make arguments nearly either way.
Right.
And but as of today, just to address your the bigger issue here is not just the split, it's how you're able to negotiate. I mean, that is for me the fundamental question that's on the board right now, is that if you're a label, you come in and you can literally pull the entire catalog
right
overnight. You're a publisher, you've got CRB, you've got the consent decree, you've got all those things which are tying. I mean, you're basically fighting with one hand tied behind your back. I mean, more than one hand.
You know? And you have a lot of hands involved. You got so many different rights.
And then we also negotiated against really companies with very small bank accounts, Google, Amazon, Apple. You know, the fight is from the get-go is absolutely unfair. They can lobby ad aeternam, and it's not even making a dent on their bank account. Whether if you're the IRA or even worse, the NMPA, you know, you don't have as much resources to go and fight.
So it kind of seems like around 2000-ish, it changed where you would have bands that became very successful and they were writing all their stuff. The greatest example is Bohemian Rhapsody, one writer. You look at the writing credits on a pop song today, it's a telephone book. I mean, it's just, do you think that that's gonna change? Anybody think that maybe, and I'm talking about the kinds of artists, I mean, maybe it's not pop music that's gonna change, but some other genre, is there any thought on that? Are we gonna get back to the artist writes their own material more so, and that impacts this, because then the artist share and the songwriter share are merged together and it makes it better, that much better. But boy, it isn't that way is it?
But you know, Bill, you had the Brill Building in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was the same.
Right.
Neil Diamond and you know, and Carole King and all of those were writing for hundreds of people. You know, so
as true, it was like that
before. Yeah, I don't think it's really
you don't think it's changed that
No,
much.
And I don't think it changes that discussion as much. I don't know. I don't want to talk for my...
Yeah,
go ahead. Yeah, I mean, I think, look, if the splits got better for songwriters, would they get more... if the splits got better for songwriters, would they actually write more songs? I think if they could write more songs, they would write more songs right now. So I think, you know, and I don't think the changes will really impact artists. The one point, though, I wanted to make earlier, just around the business side of things, And I know Bill will get into outside investments and a lot of more financial money coming into the business. But I think publishers are definitely, publishers are definitely under more pressure to generate more return. And with newer music being created, I think we see song creation businesses,
yeah.
A lot more investment into that. So I would argue that, you know, when you look at the pie, publishing businesses taking on more A&R on the song creation side, they're also incurring more costs. So it's starting to look more like an operating business, very similar to record labels. And, you know, I think that would be another argument for the split to be more balanced.
Yeah. And to your point about outside investment, you're seeing with these massive acquisition deals that you're reading about, and Bruce Springsteen, you know, $550 million allegedly. A lot of these numbers, by the way, a dirty little secret. They're not exactly accurate.
I'll tell you the real numbers.
Or Dylan, we have some dirty little secrets for you here. But you are seeing a shift, I am anyway, of moving from, it started with just with publishing only. I think it like Larry Mestel and Primary Wave in 2006 was kind of the first one to make a play for Kurt Cobain, the publishing, Aerosmith, Hall & Oates, and later Julian Lennon's inherited writer's share from his dad. He was kind of doing that at a time of, and the only way he could do it was because of the chaos in the music industry in 2006, when not long after when the Napster crash was going and people were in the industry were leaving and going into whatever, real estate or whatever, getting out of the business because it looked like it was flatlining. So he and others came in and took advantage of that and started getting into that business. But now what I'm, and that was publishing. Now I'm seeing a shift into, for the reasons you're stating, into more like record royalties. So with Dylan and with so many others, and they're buying up the record royalties. Because I think to your point, Olivier, it's just an easier transaction. You got one party that you're dealing with usually with the recordings, yep. And with the publishing, it can be a nightmare to get everybody lined up. So, as an outside investor, are you looking at that, Agnes, as, you know, maybe it's advising people to look at master rights more in terms of acquisitions and not just the publishing?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been a pickup. I think when you look at valuations, publishing historically has traded at higher multiples. So I think folks are thinking they're getting a better deal and there's better prices still up there as the market has been inflated.
And so, okay, I promised some dirty secrets. You may know this one, but it's that the majors, like, they don't want to mess with this. They like the pie the way it is. Okay, I see everybody's nodding their head. I don't have to tell you this. You paid to get in here? I'm sorry. Okay. You all know this? Does anyone not understand the reason why they want to keep it the way it is? Oh, well, no one will admit it. But we're going to... We'll say it anyway. It's because they have a publishing company over here and they have a record company over here, and the profit margin is much better on the record side, usually. Maybe that's going to change. You all get that, right? It's on the publishing side they're getting about 25% because they don't see any of the writer's share, which is about 50% of the total. And on the typical co-publishing deal, they get 50% of that, so that means they're getting 25%. On the record side, it can be, depending on, you know, this chart is showing you the streaming split at 50-50, but many deals are much more like 10-90 or something like that. So but that could be changing. Am I barking up the wrong tree, Steve?
I think that record deals are evolving. I mean, for sure, historically, an artist would get, you know, a royalty. And if it was a young artist who, you know, didn't have a track record, the royalty would be in the teens. And if it was a more established artist, it could be in the 20s or even the 30s, right? But now, you know, in new deals, it's not uncommon for artists to have 50-50 splits on streaming income. So at least that's more fair than it was. And again, remember, we keep inheriting the old business models, right? So you have all these people who did record deals in the 90s or the early 2000s, and they've got a 20% royalty, and it applies to streaming as well. So it's not, again, not really fair, but we have all these legacy deals. But as far as new deals are a lot more fair and reflect the true economics of what's going on today.
And why is it that the major labels don't want to use their own money in these acquisitions? They're getting now, as I said, like when you had in 2006 and Larry Mestel and others started getting in there and buying these rights, the labels weren't interested in doing that. But now they're certainly interested in doing that, and they don't seem to be interested in using their own money.
No, I think they are. Go ahead.
I think the majors these days, they're so interested in the large iconic catalogs, and when you have a financial partner like Sony partnered up with Eldridge, right, they just have much more taking off more financial risk, and they're able to just get more top shelf catalogs by having these financial partners. And you know, some of them do have investments in other operating assets. I think some of the partnerships create additional sync opportunities, TV and film deals that they, you know, get to take advantage of. So, you know, I don't know how many iconic catalogs are left out there, but, you
a
know,
lot.
They're...
yeah, a lot, actually. Yeah.
But they have their cost of capital, and a lot of these majors, I guess all three of them are public companies. So I think partnering up with financial sources just lets them do more of these deals and probably helps them pay up. And let's remember the splits there too, right? When they partner up, a lot of times the majors are still buying and keeping 100% of the recording royalties, but the financial partners are the ones who are splitting or acquiring the publishing royalty piece of it, and that tends to be more of the piece that the financial players are interested in.
Well, do you think that the entry and the increase in outside capital is going to change this pie, is going to put pressure one way or the other, that the publishing, that they're going to want to see more of that, or is it not going to change because they're just going
to? Huh? Absolutely, Bill, because there are so many new funds these days that, frankly, don't have a creative angle to them. They're 100% focused on publishing. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So, you know, when they look at these models, and I see these models, right, a lot of the upside here and the forecast is around the CRB rate increases, streaming growth in emerging markets and consumer rate increases. I think, frankly, a lot of them are betting on that.
And so, you know, as an artist, and some, can I, now there's some more people here, can I get a show of hands of any artists out there? Okay. And actually, now we have less than before. They all left.
The depressing conversation.
And songwriters? Okay. And so another thing that we want to talk about is neighboring rights. Anybody out there know what neighboring rights are? You're familiar with that. So some interesting developments there. Can anyone in the audience want to explain what neighboring rights is? Any volunteers? Go ahead. You want to go to the microphone?
Want me to go ahead? All right.
Yeah.
How can I do this succinctly? The primary copyright law
the way that I see it, protected, originally protected musical works on the publishing side. Then when they, many countries around the world, with the important exclusion of the United States of America, for reasons relating to the National Association of Broadcasters and so on, what happened was that all these countries decided, well, we should have equal rights for the songwriting, the sound recording side, the publishing side. So they gave all those bundles of rights, including the public performance rights, to the owners of the sound recordings, so the labels, the recording artists. So Europe, Canada, pretty much everywhere except for, you know, US and I think like North Korea or something like that. they get equal, well, not equal, but they get those bundle of rights applied to sound recordings. So there's a public performance, publishers and songwriters get paid, so do the labels and performing artists.
Excellent. Yeah. Can you give us your name?
And Chris Ware is at Berklee College of Music.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Finally paid off.
Yeah. So this is another stream of income, okay, that potentially right now it's only with regard, and I'm talking about outside of the U.S. and North Korea, as you pointed out. It's only it's generally for terrestrial radio and television and stuff like that, but there is... The UK has really stepped up, and they're legislatively looking at doing a study and looking at increasing or expanding neighboring rights to include digital. And what does that mean? Does that just mean a double payment for the on-demand streaming? Probably not. It's not quite clear, but it's probably just going to be with regard to real-time kind of linear shows, like BBC has a program or something like, so similar to radio or TV programming, but it's another source of income for the artist, which is good. Now, who's going to pay it? Who's going to pay that stuff? It's going to be the DSPs, right? I mean, who else is going to pay for that? Not clear, but they're doing that. They're doing the study, the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, is undertaking a full market study into the economic impact. And they're also, in the UK, they're also looking at a possible 20-year recapture of copyrights to the artists. But that would only be in the UK. Yeah. So I mean, it wouldn't... Go ahead.
Yeah, the lack of public performance rights for artists and labels in the United States is just one of the great historical blunders and tragedies of the music business. It has meant that artists and their labels literally left billions and billions of dollars on the table for the last, you know, 60 years, essentially. And the economics of so many artists would have been so different. So many artists who never got paid by their labels would have been paid a public performance royalty because their songs were so big on the radio, and only the writers and the publishers got that money. But the tragedy is double, right? Because since we don't give anybody a public performance royalty on the recording side, and all the other countries do, because we don't give anybody's, whether they're American or whether they're British or whatever, we don't give anybody that royalty, right? None of the other countries give American artists that royalty when their music is played in other countries. So it's literally a double disaster. So nobody gets paid here, and because we don't pay anybody here, the British don't pay our artists, right? And the French don't pay our artists, and the Japanese don't pay our artists, and nobody pays our artists. So it's this incredible disadvantage economically that American artists have been at for our lifetimes. And that's one of those things that really does need to be corrected. You know, unfortunately, we're sort of ending, we're towards the end of the terrestrial broadcast era. So in a weird way, like the horse has already left the barn. But it would be great to fix it and maybe have it fixed in a way that anticipates future technological change. But that is really, like, it's really one of the great, like, sad facts of the American music business. Like, if America had joined the rest of the world in adopting that years and years ago, there just so many lives would have been so much better of artists who gave a lot and never really made a lot of money.
But there have been ways to qualify if you are an American artist to get some of that money. If you had a member, if you recorded, primarily if you recorded, so you would see these kind of vacation destination recording studios like Chris Blackwell's Compass Point in the Bahamas. Talking Heads and so many others recorded there, and you would qualify even if you were an American artist for at least in some of these territories, mm-hmm. if not in all of them. So there were some ways that savvy people could get some of that, but it will be a lot better for the artists to have that become a thing where worldwide. And I think the reason in the U.S. that it didn't happen is because radio, big radio, has always been run since the time of Thomas Edison. Always been running circles around the talking machine, the record player. You know, in other words, big radio has always outmaneuvered the record industry. And now the question is, will the DSPs do the same thing?
I have a question.
Yeah.
for Steve over here, but. What about performance digital royalties, right? With digital radio like SiriusXM, Pandora, et cetera, right? They have to pay.
They do.
They do, right? So right, is that going to be the next?
Yeah, look, I mean, like I said, the problem is in some ways being solved by the coming of digital media, because artists do get paid when their songs are played on digital radio, including satellite radio, by Sound Exchange. So if you're an artist out there, I'm sure you've registered with Sound Exchange, and hopefully you're getting money from Sound Exchange. So the problem is there is an anticipated solution to the problem, but still there's millions and millions of dollars being made by big artists every year, big writers every year from public performance in the United States on terrestrial radio, and the artists aren't getting any of that money, and I do think that it's it's a tragedy that just keeps perpetuating.
So I want to talk about, in this case, and again, the UK is sort of like the canary in the coal mine, if you will. I mean, it's almost an experiment. See what happens there. Maybe it'll happen worldwide, this digital sound recording performance royalty. And so my question generally about government regulation, and here we are in Texas, where government regulation is not all that popular, although it could change. A lot of people moving into the state. But well, how do we feel? We have the government here. You know, we have the CRB, which is coming up with there. There's an appeal right now of CRB3, if you all know what that is. And that could come out within the next 60 days, I think it's expected, mm-hmm. Which could raise... And what we're talking about is that one of the pie things here, that one, the PubCo at 13%, it's going to expand that out somewhat. It's still kind of playing on the margins, but if it, you're going to have, you already have a 40% increase, and then CRB4 may go to 20%. So that's a thing where the CRB is involved. My question, though, is should government get involved? You know, you have like the consent decree, as you pointed out before, it's the publishers that are all, if you might say, have their hands tied behind their back with regulation. You've got, you know, the DOJ involved with the consent decrees with ASCAP and BMI, and then the CRB looking at these things, the rate courts, etc. Is government regulation a good thing, and or should it be more free market? Would we be able to just leave it to the free market to make it a more even playing field on this pie between?
Go ahead. This, I think the problem is not so much that they negotiate the rate. The problem is that you're forced to work within the confines of government regulation to determine how you get paid. So, in a sense, the benefit of having these regular updates, if you wish, and increases on rates is that songwriters throughout the past, let's say, 50 years, have more or less been able to keep up with inflation. right? Just to think of it in a very basic way. You know, I mean, I can tell you, I looked at a contract for a classical musician recently from the 50s, and that artist was at, still today at 3.5% royalty, right? If you're a songwriter, the mechanical rate, you know, has been updated regularly, and so you're, you know, you're sort of catching up with the cost of living. So that's a good side. The bad side is that when 70% or 60% of the income is coming from a few sources, you've got complete data transparency, and you don't have the complexity of collection that you used to have. You do one deal with Spotify, you collect in 180 territories. I think there's a valid case that we should be able to go directly to Spotify, to all of those, and negotiate a rate that we see, as a group, I'm talking about, right, whether it's an MPA or else, and negotiate what we feel is a fair deal. And I know the presentation is all about publishers versus labels, but the real battle for me is not taking from, you know, Universal and get myself more money, is to go to Spotify and say, okay, you got to increase the entire pie. Now, you know, their argument is that, well, you know, our margins are this and that. Great. But at the same time, it's not my problem as a publisher to figure out as to why, when I get a check from, let's say, YouTube, which is an even bigger corporate, I'm getting 15% of 55% of the split. It's ridiculous.
Right.
Absolutely ridiculous. And those companies are profitable. Spotify is private. It's not backed by a financial giant. But Amazon, Apple, Google absolutely can afford, and their business have the margins to allow for a higher rate. So for me, it's not, am I going to fight with Lucian Grange or Barnett or whoever? It's not that. It's, I'm fighting with people who are lobbying today to keep that CRB rate and try to kill it. I mean, simply, not even negotiate it, just kill it straight out, which, right, is why it's not being paid. See, when was it implemented? I don't even know. It was, what, 7 years ago, 5 years ago when it was decided? And we haven't seen a penny. So that, for me, is a real battle, is how do we get the Google of the world, the Apple of the world, to say, well, yes, we're going to grow it. And whether labels make more money along the way, I don't care. I care about them increasing the payments.
And it's interesting that Spotify is hands down the most successful in terms of people all around the world using it, I think. And yet it's the stand-up. That's their only business, is to your point, Amazon and Apple. No,
that's where they're investing.
It's a loss loser for them.
They're investing in podcasts because it makes their rates, you know, to us, lower.
I think in terms of total users, probably YouTube is bigger.
Yes.
In fact, YouTube is owned by Google, and YouTube is part of a very large advertising ecosystem from Google that makes a lot of money. And you know what happens is, as you said, really the DSPs kind of look at it in this very narrow way. We say, from the streaming business, we have a very tight margin. But the truth is, if you pull out your view a little bit wider, you realize, no, the streaming business is this one part of a very complex and incredibly profitable advertising ecosystem that they've constructed, and there's no reason that they can't actually increase the pie.
If I can just talk about YouTube for a second, I mean, just to give you a sense, I don't know how many of you know the economics, it is the most arcane and least transparent way. I mean, my friend John Razzo here from Odium and CSAC laughing, you know, I'm sure you're laughing like I am. So basically, if you're, let's say, Katy Perry, your song gets played on YouTube, you're getting a CPM, it's a click per thousand, so it's based on advertising. So if during that period where your song is very popular, you may see, let's say, $13 or $15 per thousand clicks. And then as a song gets less popular, it drops to 8, 5, 6, whatever it is, right? So you're first subject to whatever advertising is quote-unquote booked against your actual video. Then from that money, so let's say it's $10, right, you're going to have 45%, I believe, I mean, don't quote me, somebody probably can, John will correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, 45% get kept by YouTube, and then 55% is paid to all of the rights holders. And out of that, the publishers get roughly 15%. So, and imagine when you're supposed to account to a writer and say, well, I'm sorry, that week your rate was $6, but here it was 15. You don't know how it gets allocated. You have no visibility over it. And that's, for me, the kind of, you know, issues that should be solved. And by the way, when we saw all these protests around, you know, from Neil Young and Johnny Mitchell, et cetera, around Spotify, okay, I mean, I'm sure they've got a valid point, but the real culprit is here. It's YouTube. They are, to right. Steve's point, the largest platform, the least transparent, and actually the lowest payout in the record business, by far. And yet, that's the most consumed, especially when you get outside of the U.S. If you go to Mexico, 60% of consumption's on YouTube easily for music.
Yeah, in much of the world, people use YouTube as their audio streaming service, essentially.
So Spotify...
I'm done with the rent, by the way. We can move on.
You know, love Spotify or hate Spotify, it saved the music industry.
Yes.
In 2006, it launched in Sweden, and in 2011, it launched in the U.S. And who knows? It hasn't been around very long, but it's certainly a completely different business now than in 2006, which, by the way, was the same year that Larry Mestel got into acquiring the catalogs because the labels, that was a bad time for the record business. And then 2 years later, it was a bad time for everybody, 2008. But looking toward the future, you know, is it going to be 10 years from now? Who knows what it's going to be, right? And it's the 300th, last year was the 300th anniversary of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto. And how did that go so long? Because it's fucking great. I mean, it's amazing, right? And who knew? But and it was mainly, who was it that kept it alive? Other musicians, composers, academics. So what about 300 years from now? And it is, you know, streaming is just, we're living in a fast time and it gets faster. You know, what's it going to be like 300 years from now? Well, if Mike Judge, anyone see Idiocracy? hopefully Mike Judge, a proud son of Texas, is wrong in that movie because we hope that it's going to be maybe Miles Davis, the Beatles, and not like Bad Baby, Cash Me Outside that people are listening to in 300 years. But the point is that things are changing and will change. That's one thing for sure, and faster it seems like. So streaming, any thoughts on the panel about, if it's streaming right now, but then you've got the metaverse and all of this stuff. Yeah. How does that change things? Anyone?
Actually, quickly, I mean, I did an NFT for Giorgio Moroder, who is a dance, electronic and disco producer. He did all the Donna Summer records and Blondie Call Me and et cetera. He's a good friend and an amazing musician. And we got into it with the publishers. Like suddenly we had, and this is where I think it will save the songwriters, that there are no statutory rates. I don't have to call in Washington, D.C. to figure out what we're going to pay. On that simple NFT, the publishers raise their hand and say, should we get X? And we could say yes or no. And so suddenly the benefit of the metaverse is that you got to think of it as pretty much all of it is a big synchronization. It's going to have to be negotiated at every step of the way. And maybe at some point there'll be a model that emerges, which, by the way, will not be that dissimilar to any of the other free market rights and the way they've been valued. There will be a model. But today, one of the great things is that it's going to allow songwriters to finally leverage their ability to say no. And just that is good enough to sort of tilt the balance to a more equal level playing field.
We're talking about... there's also branding that you're very much involved with, and name and likeness, and how that will be another right that could be even more important than it is today in a new world, or the new worlds, or horizon worlds, or whatever they're calling it. All this new stuff that's coming out.
The shift from a audio-only to audio-visual is absolutely clear. I mean, and that means that suddenly there's a third party at the table, which is the artist and their image and their brand, etc., and that's going to have to be cleared. So you're going to have another point of leverage, also more disruption, but certainly more, a bigger voice to to change the...
And I think the biggest area of growth in digital at the moment is not really the DSPs, right? It's music as a feature, and music as a feature could be anything from TikTok and Instagram to music being used on photo sharing apps or dating apps or whatever. And I think that's an area that I think in many cases the economics are more fair, and a lot of the deals being struck with apps by the labels and the publishers through third parties, it tends to be a 50-50 split between the recording side and the publishing side. So I think as that revenue continues to grow, it'll be more fair. I'm curious, Olivia, like what are you seeing as far as income, from some of those social platforms like Instagram and TikTok? Like, how does that impact your economics?
Well, it's huge. I mean, just the way we look at it is over the next, I would say, 5 to 7 years, we think it's going to be an additional 10 to 15% of income. Now, the question is, and this is what we don't know, is does that mean that as people spend more time on TikTok, they spend less time on streaming platforms? I mean, at the end of the day, there are 24 hours in a day, and part of the challenge is that we're competing not just against ourselves, meaning in music platforms, but also competing against, the Oculus Rift of the world and Netflix and, HBO Max, just to give it props to our sponsor, and others. And so in terms of the ability to have meaningful engagement through new platforms may come at the expense of the traditional ones. We don't know. But in general, I think we have to believe that's going to generate, a good, I'd say 10-15%.
TikTok is changing a lot of things. Go ahead.
I was just going to add, it's interesting because there's all this upside, and I'm definitely seeing more of our music clients, doing NFTs and this ancillary type of business, but yet when we model forecast these different income streams, we're still very limited, and streaming is really driving most of the valuations, and folks are not really incorporating a lot of stuff that Olivia's doing right now with, focusing on name and likeness rights, et cetera. So I think there's definitely a little bit of a leg, it's good that there's additional upside for the models and the rights that have been trading and being acquired in today's very active M&A environment around the space.
And TikTok really changes a lot of things. I represent TikTok, so it's a full disclosure, and sounds like humble bragging, but I'm bragging. Yeah, I represent TikTok and have done many deals for them, but they're whole model is not based on streams or on views at all. It's based on the content. So, like, Music Reports collects in a different way for TikTok than for these other DSPs. Completely different model. So it is.
So could you elaborate and explain that model to everybody?
Can't do that. Sorry.
It's not murky at all.
It is. Another, sign of the times. So things are changing, and who knows what's going to be in the future. But right now, we've got pie, so we have to deal with that. If there are any questions, there's a mic there. If you want to get behind the mic, love to hear your questions. And one brave soul, two. He was just throwing something away. No. Oh, three. Okay. So, yeah, please.
Let's hear. Andrea C. Martin, very interesting. And, we talk about the record labels and the publishers But when we talk about how powerful they are in the world, you know, they're worth billions. They represent, what, 70 to 80% of the market? The big three, the big four?
73.
Right?
Yeah.
70, yeah.
Yeah. So that's huge, right? Mm-hmm. Around the world. And then we talk about YouTube that's owned by Google that is worth how much, right? And how powerful they are. And you look at Apple, what are we going to do about this? Because I agree, NFTs will make a big difference, but it will take some time before we start seeing the money coming in and the ecosystem and the business model working for the songwriters and composers. So what are we going to be able to do with these powerhouses? And that's my big concern. And I would love to hear what you think we can do.
Anybody, yeah.
I can go. I mean, personally, I'm not betting on changing the economics with them. I'm betting on the, excuse me, the disintermediation, where they'll be bypassed. And whether it's through D2C, whether it's, you know, whatever blockchain may bring to the table, I think that will have a much more tangible and realistic impact than the hope that little me with my little catalog will be able to arm wrestle with, you know, Google.
Yeah. So in the interim,
I hate to be depressing, but yeah.
You know, in the interim, you've got songwriters, you know, that especially through the pandemic, it has been very hard for them.
Yeah, I'm not throwing my hands up in the air. I'm just trying
to say that as an industry, we should tackle that, and we have to work around the world, not just in the U.S. or just in the U.K. to.
You know, look, that's why, you know, there's been such an acceleration in the last, say, decade or so of songwriters insisting on being producers on the songs that they write with artists, if they're not the artist, right? Because the only way to get paid is to get paid as the producer. It's kind of a shame that, you know, you're a songwriter and you're saying, well, I also am a producer of the track because I want to actually make money on this and not just be the guy who's doing it all on spec. And it's clearly an untenable situation for the songwriter.
I was just going to say, because we're on an audio feed, if you could also say your name and what you do as well. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add, I 100% agree with you. Like, the three of them have so much power. And, you know, to Bill's earlier question, I think government intervention, like, I touched upon this in the beginning, but they do what they want to do. They are running around the free market. And on the publishing side, you know, everything that was done, I know with the PRO consent decrees, they're not perfect, and there's a lot that still needs to change around, you know, the way they negotiate and streamline some of those rates, but at least there's something in place for them to be controlled, and that is the problem with that second piece of the pie. There's just nothing done there. And I think, you know, we need to tackle that. There's, I think, been a lot more voices around in the UK, and I hope it'll spill over here. But I still think that 70% market share with just three players is really big, and we got to start with that. And I know we talked about YouTube and the other pieces, but that is still a problem that's very prevalent today.
Thank you. Go ahead,
Hi, I'm John Rasso. I'm with the CSAC Music Group. We own the Harry Fox Agency, CSAC, Audium, and Mint Digital. So we do global administration of publishing. The thing I wanted to point out, going on from Olivier's comment about what to do about YouTube, you might remember there was actually an NMPA-led battle with YouTube that essentially established this format we're at now, where it determined that the YouTube platform isn't in violation. It is just, you know, it's all of the individual users. So it left a place where, yeah, you could sue for the use, but you have to go over to each kid uploading a video that they are actually the copyright violation. With that, I just want to actually, Bill, I wanted to ask you particularly about TikTok. So these services, there needs to be a little more open conversation about how to split these rights. And there is TikTok just being one of the mysteries. I mean, there's a lot of people out there. And I just wanted to hear some commentary about how can we work together to sort of share the pie a little more, so at least we know how big the pie is to a certain extent.
So I'm not going to comment about
that. I'll open it
up to my other panelists if they want to tackle that one.
The answer is yes, John.
Well, I was hoping for a little more, but okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I was trying to put you on the spot, Phil.
No, but to John's question, I think those new platforms are actually an opportunity for us to start fresh, and that I'm actually quite excited about. I think because so much of it involves video as opposed to just being audio only, I think it's going to be really beneficial for us because we can leverage more rights than just the publishing rights to tip the scale again.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey again, Chris Ware is at Berklee College of Music. This is a very fascinating panel. Thank you so much. I was thinking about the title of the panel. Is there going to be a war between the labels and the publishers?
Thanks for bringing that up. I actually changed it to strife between, just from war to strife. Why? Because we're watching real war, okay? And we're fortunate enough to be playing in the music biz sandbox, okay? And we're, all of us. And it's not war. I mean, we're seeing real war. And that's if that's your question, that's why I changed
it. It's not, but I appreciate that, too.
I'm glad I got to say that, but go ahead.
But, please. You know, one of the first things that was talked about was this challenge that the majors have no incentive. And if the majors are the labels and the publishers, they're not going to have a strife, you know.
Right, right.
And so... You know, to me, I think it would be maybe useful to reframe this question about, like, you know, how are we, I mean, who's the target audience, first of all, for this panel, but how are we maybe going, I think the question is, how are we supporting songwriters and independent songwriters? And I feel as though maybe it's looking at it differently. Agnes, you brought up a great point about the PROs and the distribution and how those performances are calculated. Because now, again, it favors heavily the major artists, right? How can we get maybe a different type of distribution or collection? Maybe perhaps also a user-centric model for royalty splits on the streaming services. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the low-hanging fruits that we can get to in the next, let's say, 2 years, not the 10-year vision? To address maybe more equitable remuneration for songwriters?
Anybody? Well, I mean, you mentioned user-centric. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that at the end of the day that that's really going to make a change?
That's a big question. I don't know. I feel as though it could, but I'm still... not sure, like in terms of general consumption, if you look at just the raw numbers, it could bring some more money back to sort of the independent songwriters and like just recording artists, just generally speaking, the independent sector. I just, you know, I'm still not convinced by the math of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I know the answer. I think that go ahead.
If it's a question of the independents versus the sort of major led and major artist, I think the first issue is not the pie, it's really the attribution. You've got a metadata problem.
Big time.
And we see it through black box settlements and distributions where if you're unable to claim, let's say, a song because you're Joe Schmo doing music in your bedroom, but you're trying, and maybe you've had, I don't know, like 10,000, 100,000 streams, most likely you'll never see that money because nobody can find you. The DSPs don't give a shit, to be honest, about trying to make that effort. And so just that is, once you start aggregating all this, what happens, all that money flows back to the large publishers, not just the majors, just large publishers, and it gets distributed pro rata based on market share. And so the long tail, which I guess is what you're talking about, the long tail is not getting compensated, not just because of rates, etc., they're getting the same payment as anyone else. It's just they're not being accounted to, period. And the MLC settlement was part of that. You know, it's all this huge amount of unattributed money that suddenly gets just, you know, here we go, hands free. You don't have to worry about the past 10 years. It's paid, you know, starting anew. But just being able to get proper attribution would be a huge step, huge step.
So we only have a few more minutes, but yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to quickly say, because I'm the boring finance person up here, but, you know, there's the music services industry is so fragmented, but there's a lot going on in it. You know, I talk to a lot of startups, and I give it to guys like Mercat Hypnosis that partner up with these small technology companies. And when you say low-hanging fruit, you know, get that extra usage and clicks and views from YouTube or whoever else to hopefully put more money in songwriter pockets. I think as, you know, we kind of move forward with the bigger picture things, but I really think technology and what people are doing in music services right now are doing in those places are hopefully bringing more to songwriters and the artists. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you. Yeah, until they kick us out, I guess we can take the questions. Okay. So go ahead.
My name is Peter Thorworth. I am a songwriter and producer. I have a suggestion and a question. The suggestion, Bob Dylan got, I believe, $300 million for his catalog, and Paul Simon got a similar figure. How can anyone spend that much money? So if my question is, how do we pass on to them, these that have received enormous checks and who I admire, how do we pass on to them the suggestion that's enough money to create a third political party? I mean, in this nation, that's what we need. And these guys, if they have cares and integrity, might want to consider that. How might we communicate that suggestion?
You just did. You just did. And I appreciate that. Yeah, I don't know what we. Yes, sir.